No, it's like an early like Homo erectus. It's one of the it's
guys, Greg said erectus.
Children, you're all children.
Beaver.
Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. Today we will be covering the film The Revenant, as well as the life of Hugh Glass, the man who starred in the movie. Not Leonardo DiCaprio, he starred in the movie. But he was Hugh Glass, and we're going to talk about mountain men and beavers and everything else in between. My name is Greg, I'm Claudius the Fool on the forums, and I'm joined by three other vassals today, if you guys want to introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Amber Rocks on the forums. Amber rocks in real life.
This is Matt Varley on the forums.
This is It Rhymes With Sleek on the forums, Jack in real life.
And Jack, this is your first VOK, correct?
Yep.
So, before we get into the actual podcast, do you just want to talk about how you got into Vassals of Kingsgrave and Song of Ice and Fire and all that? Just give us how you found your way to the forums?
Yeah, actually, I had a friend who recommended Game of Thrones, the book, to me in high school. And I ended up reading it, and I thought it was great, but it wasn't like the only thing in my life. And then about a year later, I got two real bad traumatic brain injuries, and I had a lot of trouble focusing with my eyes on reading. But I picked up the audiobooks for the rest of that series and just got enthralled. And I found VOK from listening to Preston Jacobs on YouTube, I think.
Wow, that's not usually the way.
Yeah. It was a suggested thing, and I ended up hopping over to the site, and it's pretty great.
And Jack, you are not really able to watch TV, is that right?
Right. I can't look at TV screens because they give out a different kind of light than computer monitors and cell phones.
So you have no experience of the show?
Oh, I've watched the show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I only watched about the back end of season 4 and season 5 when my head started getting a little better and I could stand to sit in a room with the TV for a while.
Yeah.
So maybe this is after show material, but would you be willing to share how you got the TBI?
Yeah. Soccer. Both of them.
Oh.
Head to head for the first one and ball to head for the second one.
Jesus.
Yeah. It sucks.
Had the second one happened first, would it not have been as bad?
The second one wouldn't have even happened if I didn't have the first one. What the neurologists told me is that with each concussion you get, they get worse and they get easier to get. So,
yeah.
Jeez.
The second one was something that I had done 1,000 times before, and that time
it's playing soccer.
Really got to me.
Yeah. Well, TBI can happen with anything, really. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, you could head a ball in soccer and get a TBI. I used to work at the VA up in Boston, and they did obviously a lot of TBI research for returning veterans. And one of my labs is now doing mitochondrial research regarding TBI.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how much they've learned and how much they still don't know. I was having really bad migraine issues at one point, and the doctor gave me an injection, and they said, "This will get rid of your migraines in 15 minutes, and we'll come back.
Was it a steroid?
I don't know what it was. And they came
oh,
back
that's
in
good.
15. Yeah, I know. They came back in 15 minutes and I didn't feel any different.
Oof.
Great.
But then they got me on a medication that really helped. So different stuff. Mm-hmm.
So how long ago was that?
That was my sophomore year in high school. So I was 16 at the time, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I stubbed my toe this morning and it really hurt. So.
God damn it. That's smart.
And as Matt knows, I almost drowned in a channel at the beach, so I've had a bad day.
And my sinuses are inflamed, and my whole fucking head hurts. But on that note, let's talk about real ouchies. Hugh Glass.
Yeah, let's. I just want to talk about briefly of how, you know, when did you hear about Hugh Glass? Was it the movie or before? Or, you know, my introduction was from a podcast called The Dollop, which we've mentioned several times before. And I really never heard about the guy before, but that was right when the book The Revenant was reissued, because The Revenant came out about 10 years ago. It's by Michael Punke, I guess is how you say it, Punke. And they reissued it in hardcover because the movie was coming out last year. And that was my first introduction to Hugh Glass. I've read a lot of Western histories, you know, Lewis and Clark and stuff like that, but I've not really read much about the fur trade and the, you know, the Rocky Mountain Fur Company in particular. But I knew like Jim Bridger and Bill Sublett and those guys, but I just didn't really know Hugh Glass, and that was my introduction to him, and I've read a couple of books since then. But what about everybody else?
Yeah, just the dollop for me, actually, and then we finally just got to the movie last weekend, and I have done no other research than that, so you guys can school me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was the movie, and then Greg, you recommended the dollop, and that was pretty cool, but like the whole Mountain Man thing, I think I loved Jeremiah Johnson, like that movie for like ever, and that's based on Jebediah Smith, who is also part of Ashley's 100 on that on the fur.
Yeah, pretty much every famous mountain man was like in was with Ashley or Henry or in this expedition at one point. All the big guys were there. What about you, Jack?
I actually grew up in a house where my dad was a real Western history buff, so I heard about Hugh Glass when I was maybe around 10. Along with Jim Bridger and all those other types of people. And it was just his one-off story of how badass he was.
Did you know what Old Ephraim was? I had no idea who Old Ephraim was until I read the biography. But did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, because that's like that was apparently the old Western term for a grizzly bear. Like, and people would say, oh, when Glass met Old Ephraim, like that's what they mean. That's the grizzly attack.
Ephraim, like the name? Ephraim?
Yeah, it's from the passage in the Bible. Like, there's some connection to it that way, but it's...
Huh.
And also they're called white bears, which made no sense. And then apparently they have like white tipped fur. That's why they're called white bears, but they're not.
Oh, yeah. The bristles on their back have a little bit of a white tip to them when they get old.
Drop them knowledge.
So we should just briefly mention the books that we might be mentioning or that are good suggested reading for the topic. The movie The Revenant is based on the book The Revenant, which came out in 2003 and then was reissued again last year. 2002, sorry.
There's which we should... say is fictionalized.
It's a novelization, but it's very well researched. You know, there's a huge bibliography in the back, and he even says in the historical note that he took some liberties, but pretty much all of the actual characters or what happened to them, like that happened to them as far as we know. There's also a really great biography called The Saga of Hugh Glass by John Myers Myers, whose parents had little or no sense of humor, or too much sense of humor.
Or creativity.
Yeah. But he is a huge fan of Hugh Glass, so you do have to take it with a grain of salt, but he does, reach to every available resource of the time. This came out back in the 50s, but it's been reissued in paperback by Bison Books. But it's a really great, it's one of the most entertaining biographies I've ever read, because the guy writes like a cowboy, and he's just so in love with the time period that it's the whole thing reads like an episode of Deadwood. But it's definitely worth giving a shot. And then there's another book called Lord Grizzly by Frederick Manfred, which actually was a National Book Award nominee back in 1953, which is similar to The Revenant. It's a fictionalized account, but it covers much more of the life of Hugh Glass rather than just the time, the bear attack and the time right after.
Cool.
All right. And I found some thesis online that I'll drop my beaver knowledge on.
You want to talk about beavers?
Okay.
Challenge. Well, I have questions because you had mentioned that you were in a beaver attack, so we can start off talking about that if you'd like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that beaver video didn't
every beaver attack video I found is like a very slow moving beaver and then just a shaky film as the person runs away from the beaver and then the beaver walking away slowly again. So not exactly attacks.
I was in a boat when I was attacked by a beaver. I grew up in northern Wisconsin and there was a marsh out by our cabin where we kayaked around. And apparently some beaver took exception to me that one time. I'd seen him 100 times before. And he was swimming under my boat as fast as he could, faster than I could keep track of, and he'd pop up on either side and splash me with his tail.
I think that means he liked you.
Which so far it sounds adorable.
it was really cool at the time. It wasn't scary at all. And my dad actually got splashed another time when he fell off the dock, and when he splashed in the water, the beaver thought that was a challenge. So he got splashed too. So we named our cabin the Angry Beaver Lodge.
Nice.
So beavers, so
there
when they
was
attack,
no attack?
Yeah, they don't like actually like stab. Like I don't know, they bite you. They go for the claws. They just like flap their tail at you. That's the, I don't know.
If they're on land or if you like stick your fingers out, they do bite you, because there are stories about people getting bit by beavers. But in my experience, it's only challenging you by splashing with their tails.
Gotcha. So you chose not to accept the challenge.
I didn't. I couldn't beat it in manly fisticuffs, so.
So I have a bunch of friends up in Maine that trap beavers still, and you could still get good money for a pelt, apparently, despite PETA and all the...
Oh, yeah.
Apparently they're good
beaver hat fashion.
Oh, yeah. I actually trap beavers with a friend of mine out here, among other things.
Do you get decent money for them?
Yeah, I think the pelts right now go for around $60. which is all right, considering.
You don't have to become friendly to, like, the local Native American tribe and then marry one of their women and then have you go out trapping with your kid. And, like, that's because originally, like, you know, white men were not technically allowed to go out and trap. They had to, it was all, like, through the tribes that they got the pelts.
But yeah, Montana's pretty loosey-goosey about that stuff.
Yeah, so what I was reading was, like, in 1760, England bought, like, 3.3 million beaver hats, which was basically, at the time, a beaver hat for every citizen of the island.
Wow.
So that's how lucrative it was that the fur trade, you know, really expanded, and the demand was high for beaver hats, beaver felt, because they'd use underneath the bristles, there's, like, a really light hair that they can make into felt wool. So that's what really drove, like, you know, all the hunting and trapping and why people would want to live in this fucking miserable fucking world. And so, yeah, I mean, it was very lucrative, of course, like bear skins and buffalo hides as well. But, you know, for it was specifically like the beaver top hat, like
the pinnacle of fashion.
Yeah. Exactly. And it all started when the Huguenots left France and brought their hat making and fashion sense with them to England.
It all goes back to the French.
Aren't they?
Dude, I told you I researched the beaver.
No, I was waiting. Yeah, no, we know. No, there was a huge, it was a huge business that for like 30 years there was, you know, the most desire, aside from like, you know, higher end stuff. But no, there was a huge demand for beaver pelts. And eventually that moved, you know, once like the King of England started wearing like a silk hat and a cloth hat, then the whole bottom fell out of the industry and no one wanted beaver pelts anymore. But then they moved on to like buffalo robes and everything. So no, people could make a good living. And that's where these companies started was, you know, the Rocky Mountain Fur Company, the Missouri Fur Company. They would just
Hudson
put
Bay.
Together. Yeah, Hudson Bay. They would put together these groups of, you know, roughneck men and they would go out and spend years out there and ship their hides back or you know, sell them through agents, but it was a huge business back then.
I'm pretty sure like the American Army at one point was just protecting the fur traders.
Oh yeah.
So like they'd go massacre Indians because they were fucking up the fur trade.
Oh, the military.
You know, not just
the military
reason.
Protecting commercial interests. I don't hear of such things.
Since day one, buddy.
I don't know. I'm friends with a bunch of ROTC guys, and they come along when I'm trapping.
There you go.
It goes count? On.
Yeah, so I just figured we'd speak a little bit about the life of Hugh Glass, because the film The Revenant basically covers right before the bear attack, and then the next couple months. It probably covers about 3 or 4 months in his life, but a lot of stuff happened before it got to that point. And to be completely honest, I missed the first 10 minutes of the movie. I was running really late. The first scene I saw was in the middle of the attack on the you know, the encampment. Was there much before that, or is that pretty much
where you missed nothing?
Okay, because yeah, like the first scene walking. I saw was like Hugh, you know, and his son butchering the deer, and then like the guy, the naked guy coming in who got shot with an arrow. That was like the first.
Yeah, scene. You missed him shooting the deer.
Oh, okay. I thought I missed like a whole setup scene. All right, that's good. I feel much better.
You missed a flashback.
Award-winning cinematography.
Oh, there's plenty of that though.
Yeah. Missed a flashback of his wife getting killed, I think.
Okay, because they do show that. I think there was another flashback,
plenty.
Which they show that later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole beginning. Yeah, the beginning scene was, yeah, his wife getting killed and being like, as long as you draw breath, you live. And that was kind of like the repetitive thing throughout the movie and why he was just completely fucked but continued to go on. Where gotcha. I would have just laid down and died.
Should we give it, I don't know if we're talking about this now, but should we give it beaver cakes?
Beaver pelt. Yeah, we'll do beaver ratings, but let's we'll wait till we, because we're not actually talking about the movie yet. We're doing a little history. This could be a new thing in VOK where we actually drop some knowledge before talking about the fictional thing we're talking about.
Well, since we started with the beavers, I think it's an okay precedent.
Absolutely, it's fine. All right, yeah. So he's like younger. His early days is no one knows particularly. I mean, he's from Philadelphia, and really up until, I mean, you had mentioned, Jack, that he had apprenticed with a gunsmith.
Yep.
I don't remember reading that in the biography I read, because I guess the stuff that's accepted or from the couple books I read was nothing really before he became a mariner, you know, was 100% known. But is that pretty much accepted, or?
Well, I don't know. So the source that I heard it from said that they had found an old newspaper ad. Apparently the guy he was apprenticing for was kind of a dick, and his apprentices kept running away, and they had found an ad for this guy asking, he was paying like 6 cents if they would return Hugh, who had ran away.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
We'll go for that. Because in the book, The Revenant, they mention that he has an Anstatt rifle, and like it was like the one fancy thing that he owned, and he, you know, it was like his most prized possession. But in the movie, like, they never really I don't think he really, it didn't look particularly like it had an engraving and everything on it, but I wasn't sure if that was an Anstaut rifle or not.
Like, even his birth, like, I couldn't find a solid date for his birth. I think everything I saw was, like, circa 1783.
Right.
And yeah. Died about 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said they're pretty sure he was in his early to mid 40s at the time of the bear attack.
Right.
Obviously, everything from when the time he joined, when he was taken prisoner by the pirates, that's pretty much where most of the stuff is known.
Which gave him the nickname Old Hugh, mm-hmm. among the guys.
So yeah, so he was a mariner, and at one point his ship was attacked by the pirate Jean Lafitte, who was before the War of 1812, and when Lafitte had this kind of carved out a little bit of a pirate empire in Texas and Louisiana. And he basically gave him the choice to die or become a pirate. So he was forced to become a pirate for a couple of years. And I'm sure it's not as romantic as it sounds. I just assume they were dirty all the time. But
he said parlay.
And eventually he had an opportunity to escape from the pirates. Set up this pirate island in Galveston, Texas, which was an island off the coast of the mainland. He had to swim through a mile through water to the land. And then he was captured by Indians. And one of the guys escaped. Oh, go, you say?
Oh, no, Lafitte's, little thing in Galveston was called Campeche.
Campeche, right.
And it was just kind of like a pirate, hold out, whatever.
But it was, kind of done, with the wink and a nod from the government, because it was kind of, a little bit of a buffer between Mexico and America. And he really didn't become, a quote-unquote hero until the War of 1812, and then they let him do what he wanted for a while.
Yeah.
So he escapes to the mainland, and he's captured by Indians. His friend is, I believe, burned at the stake. He's killed somehow. We pretty sure think he was burned at the stake. But Hugh...
Well, I just re-listened to the dog.
What I read was he was hung up and, injected with pine needles.
Yeah.
That was
and then needles. Lit on fire.
So, hundreds of pine needles.
I forgot
needles.
About the pine needles before he was burned at the stake. Skin. Apologies.
Yeah. So after seeing what his butt, I feel like I've read a thing, when he was captured by Lafitte, it was you could join us or die, and basically, his entire deck was, covered in gore. So, again, he's just, witnessed something horrible, and is I'm gonna live.
Right. Why did he get the choice?
Well, I assume they, did away with the anyone who they thought wouldn't be an able-bodied seaman and the women, I assume. But
who was on the boat wasn't an able-bodied seaman though?
Who could be? I don't mean that as in the term, the role, but literally an able-bodied person. Able seaman fourth class. That's not what I meant. Or whatever.
Rear admirals. Yeah.
Get it out of your system, guys.
I don't think it's gonna get out all the way.
Nope.
Out.
It's not.
No, it's not.
That's what she said.
So right. Anyway, before he was killed in some ritual sacrifice, he had this jar of vermilion, which is a red pigment, and he rubbed it all over his face and started reciting the Lord's Prayer and jumping around and dancing, and he scared the crap out of them, and the leader of the tribe thought he was some kind of medicine man, and he basically was like, okay, you can join us now, and he became an Indian after becoming a pirate. So he joined the Pawnee and he lived as them, and
Native American.
I know. I'm not saying that to be derisive. It's just one less word. I'm sorry. I'll be more PC. Native American.
They've actually gone back to preferring American Indian now.
American
so
Indian. All right. I'll stick with that.
You can shorten it to Indian.
All right. He said it's okay. Anyway,
the white Irish guy said it's okay to call him Indian.
At least I wasn't saying Injun.
Oh, cut that, please.
All right. Yeah, so he lived as an Indian for many years, and
Jesus Christ.
All right. So he joined the Pawnee, lived as an Indian for several years.
Does anybody remember if there were any Hugh Glass references in Parks and Rec?
I know. I was having a hard time reading Pawnee and not being Parks and Rec.
I didn't even think of that, but no. I believe all the stuff they mentioned about Indians was just murder and pillage of Indian tribes on their murals in their courthouse.
Yeah, from the first season when they show the mural of the City Hall in Pawnee, where it's just the Indian strapped to a tree with a cannon.
That's right. I'd like to think Ron Swanson knows about Hugh Glass. I'm sure he does.
Oh, totally. He's probably a hero.
So yeah, so he lived with the Indians, probably took a wife. As far as we know, he never had a son, and that whole aspect of the film was completely fabricated. From everything I found, I never really found a reference to any son that he had.
He definitely had a kid with him.
He did?
Yeah.
but yeah. not
but
like,
not with him when he was with exactly. Ashley's party. And at one point when they made, you want to talk about this, John, when they went to St. Louis for like a delegation of some sort, that's when he kind of rejoined society, civilized society.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting.
Sorry, I said John.
Yeah, my name is Jonathan, so there you go.
Oh, there we go.
I thought this was really interesting. So yeah, he joined a couple of delegates from the Pawnee to St. Louis, Missouri. And all that's ever said in the records, the official records, is that they were meeting with government officials. And what that made me think of is back then the United States had a policy where if we knew that we were coming up on Native Americans' land and we wanted to take it from them, but we didn't want to outright fight them for it, we would take the leaders of their tribe and we'd bring them back to our big cities like Washington, D.C. or St. Louis, which wasn't a big city back then. And we would purposely show them how many people there were there and what kind of weapons we had. And there was no arsenal in St. Louis, Missouri at the time, but there was a fort north of St. Louis called Fort Bellefontaine. And I suspect that they probably brought the Pawnee to that fort to see the arsenal and just show them how outmatched they were. And I was thinking maybe that's what convinced Hugh Glass too, to resign his Indianship. And I thought, I was looking up even more on what might have prompted this sort of thing. And there was actually a big outrage all over the United States at the Pawnee at that time, or just before that, about the Morning Star ritual that the Pawnees performed. And that was a ritual which involved human sacrifice. And that did not go over well.
Yeah, I was actually just reading about this in a book about the planets, because they're one of the few Native American tribes that had a very good understanding of the solar system, and it was all about the rising and setting of Venus. That's what the ritual was for.
Yep. Right. And there was an 1818 edition of the Missouri Gazette published describing this thing, and that was out of St. Louis. And the delegation came there in 1821, I think, and they ended up ceding land in 1825. So apparently it worked.
And just for references, this is all happening right now. We're at about 1823, I believe. 1824. Because the attack was in 1825, right?
No, the attack was 1823.
Yeah, the attack
was... Okay, this was 1822 then, when he joined up.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's other tribes doing cannibalistic stuff. Like, I remember reading, like, when they were leaving Galveston, they had to, like, stay away from, like, the Taquaras or something, who would chop off the feet and hands of their enemies and eat them to give them speed and strength.
A lot of it was, like, embellished and fabricated, you know, because they're the dirty savages and everything.
Right.
But I believe that was because it was, a pre-war or a war ritual, what you do to your enemy, you know, to, like, gain his strength and stuff. I don't think they were, like, going around just chopping off people's feet to eat them. I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't think the problem ever really was that they were sacrificing humans. I mean, that probably played into it. I think the reason that became so talked about in the years leading up to the Pawnee ceding land is because we were coming up on them. We were expanding outwards towards them, and they were one of the more powerful tribes in that region.
Correct. Even though they're like almost at constant war with the Rees.
Yeah, but their population prior to us was big.
Well, every native population prior to smallpox was big.
A lot bigger.
Bigger than most. They put off getting smallpox for longer than most tribes.
So everybody else should have been eating hands and feet.
Yeah. Instead, they went to St. Louis and got some blankets.
Oh.
So pretty much this is when Glass joins up with General Ashley was the guy who put the whole thing, the whole organization together. He was a militia commander who kind of like underwrote all of the Henry's troops, and Major Henry was the guy who actually led the expedition that the movie starts off in. But Ashley had led one before, and they'd both been up the Missouri before. So the movie pretty much picks up right around here, right? This is right at the beginning of the attack by the Arikara.
Yeah. Also known as the Rees, just in case we...
Or the Rickarees, or the Rees. Anytime it's Rees, Arikara, it's all the same. They're like the bad guys throughout the whole movie.
The Re-Rizzles?
Re-Rizzles, I like that one. On the Dalip episode, my favorite part is when Dave goes, and then Hugh Glass said, they're not Sioux, they're Rickarees, run!
Yeah, that's later.
Yeah, that comes later. So that's pretty much where the movie starts, so we can... I mean, we're not going to go scene by scene or anything. We just discuss the film as a whole, because it's very long.
Yeah, it's like 2.5 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, it felt long. It was like, okay, we can do without a lot of these scenes.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of repetition.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, about you guys, but, like, the sun glares, like, some people, like, have issues with sun glare, like, hitting the lens and, like, taking them out of it. I was more taken out of when he was breathing and it fogged up the lens. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's differing opinions on how many people died, because in that first raid, I heard 15 or 17 or 18.
Yeah,
did you guys get different numbers?
12 killed, and then it just said dozens others wounded, including Hugh, who was shot in the leg.
Yeah, he got a musket ball shot in his, like, left thigh.
Yeah. And if anyone's... we should also mention the Song of Hugh Glass, which is this, like, kind of epic poem written by John Neihardt in 1920. Anyone else actually read it? I've just skimmed over it. I haven't read it all the way through.
Hero of the Aryan Race?
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, I just kind of skimmed it.
But it takes a lot of liberties with what actually happened, but during this attack, like, he actually has Hugh Glass taking Jim Bridger and, like, putting him over his knee and spanking him at one point.
Yeah.
And he's like, get out of here, you young whippersnapper. And I'm pretty sure that's just in hindsight because they, you know, had some goings on later on, but I can't imagine that actually happening.
But Jim Bridger was young. He was 17 at the time of the whole Hugh Glass thing.
Which back then, considering how early they had died, he's like 12. He's probably already having his midlife
crisis. Or like 55.
Yeah, I was going to say, wouldn't that make him like 40?
Yeah, that's true. Maybe he's like buying a new nice horse because he's finally realized he's halfway there.
No, but the opening scene in the movie is one of the most, it's probably realistic portrayals in film of an actual, you know, Indian attack. You know, it's not cut and dry like a John. You know, you don't see an arrow going to a guy, kills over and dies. There's blood, there's guts. It's just a very realistic and very disturbing attack. It was wonderfully shot. It almost felt like it was one long scene. But yeah, in the movie, it makes it seem like 50, 60 people died because there's only like 12 people left on the boat. But in reality, I believe it was pretty much the opposite, where more people got away than were there, but a good chunk were killed. That was kind of the spark, you know, because after this, there was, you know, the army got involved, General Ashley came up, and there was this whole siege of the Arikara villages, which they didn't even do in the movie. In the movie, they just kind of jumped from the attack to the, you know, to the 12 guys who escaped and kept going.
Right. And that one roving band looking for his daughter or whatever.
Right. And there were, the Arikara were roving, there were bands of them because they were apparently, most of the Arikara agreed to like a ceasefire and an agreement, but there was a chunk of them that said, F this, we're not doing this, and they caused trouble for Hugh Glass pretty much until the end of his life.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, so the survivors of the Arikara attack, they decided to push on. They're trying to get to the headwaters and to continue their, you know, trapping mission. They had all these pelts with them, and at some point, that's when the bear attack happens, and that's the sort of climax of the film. Should I read the actual account of the bear attack from the book? Because it's pretty gruesome.
Oh, you mean where the bear takes a bite out of his back and then feeds it to his children and then continues to maul him?
Yeah, it didn't. It seemed like it was. There were several stages to it, but
do it.
Yeah, read it.
I don't know if I really bought into that band of natives looking for the woman, because, like, if you're looking at any of the mountain men back then, they would marry like three different Indian women, and
it'd be cool with the tribes.
They really treated their women like crap. Like, they didn't give a shit.
Oh, I assume, I'm not that doubting that that didn't happen, but I assume that was one of the things that was just made up for the movie.
You know, Hollywood natives.
Yeah. And also, we should say in the movie that Hugh has his son with him, which is one of the largest changes. You know, he's part of the band that joins Ashley's men, Henry's men. Post-attack, it features more. But he's there, which in reality, that was not the case. All right, so this is like he takes a bunch of different accounts into effect, but this is from the book by Myers. The bear charged him and caught him. Before he could set his triggers, he was seized by the throat and raised from the ground. Casting him again upon the earth, his grim adversary tore out a mouthful of the cannibal food, which had excited her appetite, and retired to submit the sample to her yearling cubs, which were near at hand. The sufferer now made an effort to escape, but the bear immediately returned and seized him again at the shoulder. She also lacerated his left arm very much, and inflicted a severe wound on the back of his head. In order to be able to swing with the paws, the bear broke her charge and rose up on hind legs, giving ample time for Hugh to launch an aimed bullet. That is the only thing which saved Hugh's life, was the shot he was able to fire. So that's basically the attack, and then of course he took out his knife and stabby, 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 and then they basically ended up with like the bear dead on top of him, and that's when his men found him.
Well, in the movie,
yeah, in the
movie. In real life, the shot like told everyone like, "Oh, what the fuck are you doing? We're being like tracked by Reese, like, that one gunshot has to be, like, important.
Right.
And the so terrible bloody screams.
Yeah, and they shot the bear.
Weren't there a couple of other guys with him when he
there's was there's differing accounts, because the one guy, Black Harris, who they seem to quote a lot, at least in this book, because he was there and he wrote an account of it later on. But he two of his men actually came and, like, one of them shot at them and then missed and then ran to the middle of a river and was attacked by a cub and he killed the cub. But as far as we know, like, Hugh was alone when the actual attack happened, and they found him pretty soon after that, because he was always, like, the outrider. He was always hunting for food, or the he was always on point in all their travels usually.
Good old Hugh.
Good old Glass. So then his runes, Glass had not less than 15 wounds, any one of which, under ordinary circumstances, would have been considered mortal. A tear in the throat, which spurted a red bubble every time Hugh breathed. Then there were the lacerations of his scalp, his face, his chest, his back, one shoulder, arm, hand, and thigh. Tore nearly all to pieces. And the wonder is that he kept enough blood inside him to hold life there. So that's the attack, and that's the condition he was in.
Well, I also read that, like, his back was so fucked, like, you could see his ribs.
Yeah, I read that somewhere, too.
Like, and that, and in, like, was it a Sioux tribe, like, took pity on him and actually, like, sewed the bear pelt onto his back for skin?
We're not there yet.
And yeah, I know, but, I mean, that's
it's not in the movie, so that's fine.
And from then on, whenever he got on a horse, he was riding bareback.
Well done. You take that back immediately.
Ever.
Yeah, so after the attack, they, you know, his men tried to help him as best they could. I believe Major Ashley in the movie, like, actually sewed his throat. He had some rudimentary medical training, or at least knew how to sew. But they did not have a doctor or a barber or anyone with them to actually do any difference. And they tried taking with him, but at one point they decided that they couldn't go on with him, so he basically offered two men to stay with him until he died, and that was John Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger. As far as we know, everyone seems to agree that Fitzgerald
they
was one of
Ashley,
them.
They being Ashley, though.
What's that?
They being Ashley, not like Hugh Glass is like, nah, just leave me behind.
No, he couldn't say anything, sorry, yeah. And I keep saying Ashley. Ashley's not here. It's Major Henry is the guy who's in charge of the expedition at this point. So Henry basically gave him, like, a pay raise and a bump if they stayed with Hugh until he died, buried him, and then catch up with everybody else.
He probably had plenty of money to give him a raise from all the other guys dying.
Right. And Fitzgerald and Bridgers thought, like, okay, we'll chill around for a couple hours and wait for this guy to die, and we've already dug the shallow grave, and we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then 5 days later, he's still not dead.
Yeah. And we don't know. I mean, this is all history in hindsight. Like, they always make Fitzgerald out to be this evil, bitter man. Like, we don't know. We don't know that, because no one really knows much about Fitzgerald personally and what happened to him later on, especially after he kind of rejoined the army and just disappeared. But he is the bad guy of the movie. And the movie does kind of make Bridger out that he wasn't as complicit in it. He kind of was forced to go along. I mean, at one point he, like, draws a knife on him and punches him. And he's like, this is what we're doing. But still, you know, he did have responsibility in it, and I think he kind of accepted that later on, at least.
Yeah. I mean, in the movie, Tom Hardy is just great. But
it's the best part of the movie for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they do bring in Tom Hardy killing his kid.
Right.
That's like, in front of him.
Yeah. As if he needed another reason as to why this is a bad guy. So
like, historically, his vengeance was just because they left him, not because he killed, like, his child or something. Right. But that's just Hollywood.
When I had heard this story before, I was always under the impression that Glass was in, like, a coma, and that he stopped breathing or something, and they just thought he was done. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But we don't know, because who's going to tell that story? And Bridger obviously never, you know, wasn't just bragging about this time. This is the one, you know, shameful thing that he did, really.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and there's a lot of conflicting information, but in the movie, like, Tom Hardy's a bad guy.
Right. But with good reason for him, at least, because he tells that whole story of how he was, you know, a take scalp bite. You see how his hair's all messed up, and he talks about how he was scalped and the pain, and he has reasons to be bitter. I'm giving him that. And the whole time they're on the run, he's the one who's always complaining and, like, let's leave him. We should, you know, he always just wants to get paid and wants to get back, and yeah, he's the bad guy.
Yeah, and he's always calling them savages, and, you know, even to Hugh Glass's, you know, fictional son that's with them on the trip, it's like, why are we bringing this savage with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, they couldn't have, he's like a perfect villain, whereas just from the story, I mean, it's kind of, yeah, you got to have some sympathy for him waiting around knowing that his time is running out while he's waiting for dude to die.
Yeah. And from what I've read, it was seriously just like, a scouting party, like the whole reason they wanted to leave Glass is a scouting party saw Reese like 2 miles behind us. So we got to get going. And that's why they're offered like such big bonuses just to like stay around and give them proper burial. And they literally thought it'd be hours. And then it's like 5 days later, they're like, okay, we're going to be killed by these Indians. And that's it.
Yeah. So they do decide to leave him. And, you know, they don't just leave him. They basically take all his, because they have to decide, like, if they have to agree that, okay, we're leaving, we're going to tell them we buried him, he's dead. But they can't just leave him his shit to survive, because they would be like, hey, why didn't you take his stuff? So they had to take literally everything, his gun. And the big thing was that they took his rifle. That was the one thing that could have made a difference. And that was the, you know, the lie that was agreed upon, was that they would just tell people that he had died and they took care of him. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, and there's some good, like, line where Hugh Glass is just like, a flint and a knife is all I need.
Later on, well, that's pretty much all he had. Yeah, he didn't even have a knife at this point. He had, like, a razor blade and then whatever, you know, crap was lying around.
Well, in The Revenant, the book, he assigned some more importance to the rifle by saying that, like, Hugh Glass carved a star into it with his kid, and that the rifle is what he has to remember his kid by. And they changed it for the movie against the author's will.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was kind of interesting. I didn't know that either. I was reading something about, of all of the retellings of Hugh Glass's story, this is the only one where it's not about the rifle. And every other one, he really wants to
be the most famous one.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting too that Michael Punky, he's a diplomat and he's on active service now, and he was not allowed to give any like official interviews, or he couldn't really have any say in the movie. I mean, this was an Oscar contender and there was a lot of hype about it, but there really were very few official interviews, or I really didn't read many statements about him. It's all like secondhand, but because he just legally was not allowed to respond to the questions.
Right. He works for the UN, doesn't he? Like the World Trade Organization or something?
According to his bio, he serves as the U.S. ambassador to the World Trade Organization. Yep.
There you go.
And he lives in Montana, so he's right around you. I assume everyone in Montana knows each other. It's just a small state, right?
He's your neighbor, 35 miles away.
There's only a million people in the state.
Are you one of those states that has more senators than congressmen?
Yes. Yes, it is. No. No, we have 3 congressmen and 2 senators.
Oh, okay. There's one state. Maybe it's Wyoming that only has 1 congressman.
Yeah, Wyoming has 500,000 people.
Jesus Christ.
They're the least populous state. Rhode Island beats them.
Even then Alaska?
Oh, yeah. Alaska beats them by a long shot. There is nobody in Wyoming.
All right, let's change the topic before it gets political. I tend to go on that way a little bit.
You started it.
I did.
Well, Trump would give Montana. I'm done. Right.
Okay.
Just joking.
Did anyone just want to talk about how the attack was portrayed in the movie? Because it's one of, I mean, I've seen, you know, I like The Edge. That's one of my favorite movies. And even like the bear attacks in that movie, like it's just like a quick cut of like a paw smacking a guy's face. But this was pretty brutal to watch. And it went on for much longer than I expected it to. And like, I was looking around at people in the theater and like everyone was like viscerally like reacting to it as the attack was going on.
Yeah. Same with my experience in the theater. And I think it's really cool that it was actually a stunt guy, like in the, like the little like dot suit, mm-hmm. being the bear.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really?
Oh yeah.
So the whole thing was CG?
It was just like this huge guy in like, you know, wearing a Gollum suit that they turned into a bear.
Was it?
Huh. Well, Bart the Bear died in 2000, so they couldn't use him.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was vicious. At one point, I thought, like, the bear was penetrating Leo.
Well, he was.
Well.
She. This is a mama bear.
She was. Yeah, I don't know. The whole movie, I kept hearing about how brutal and hard to watch it was, and we didn't see it till maybe a month after it was out, and I'm assuming that's why. Either that or I just have no soul, but it didn't really bother me all that much. I mean, it was brutal to watch, but it was almost more like, wow, this is really fucking impressive.
Yeah. Oh no, and like
every time they would show his wounds, it was, I just kind of kept thinking, that is amazing makeup artistry. Like,
and that's what he deserved.
It was
the
almost
Oscar.
So real. Yeah. That it wasn't even real.
Right.
Mm. I thought it was really great, and just like you said earlier, it just keeps going on and on and on, and it gets to a point where you're just thinking, stop, you know, not his hand now it's his leg now, you know, it's just unbelievable. And then knowing while that's happening that he copes with all of this as you watch it, it's like, wow.
I was glad they didn't have the little baby bears getting in on the action though.
Yeah.
Well, to most
accounts. Because that really happened,
the,
right?
The baby bears were slaughtered.
Yeah. I don't think they show that in the movie because, you know, they do. You do see, like, the skin bear in the background when they're eating it, but I don't think they show the baby
bears.
No,
they run up to him while he's under the bear, and then they go, hey, look, there's cubs, and the cubs run away, and then they find him.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and that's the reason for most grizzly attacks anyway, or black bear attacks, is, like, you get too close to their cubs.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
When they become real aggressive.
Understandably so.
I actually, I was on a horseback ride out in Wyoming one time by Yellowstone Park, and our horse ride got between a grizzly and her cubs.
Oh, jeez.
And all these dude ranch horses are too stupid to move off the trail, so they only move forwards. So my horse just kept going.
At least you were on a horse.
It was horrifying.
Everyone survived, I take it.
Yeah, the guy got
or anything.
The guy
Jack
got
survived.
The guy had his gun out and everything. He was very concerned about it, but nothing came of it.
You found the one bad parent of all the grizzlies who just didn't give a shit. Yeah.
The negligent.
Well, she was like nosing through a dumpster or something. She wasn't actually like needing to hunt for food. She's like, oh, campers, you bring food. I'll let you get in between, like, me and my cubs.
All right, so this is where the great, you know, survival tale actually starts, where Hugh, you know, crawls off his pallet, and he basically has, like, one arm and one leg that he can use. And, I mean, the books, they didn't really show this in the movie, because I don't know how you can film it, but he kills he finds a rattlesnake that's kind of, like, full, because it just ate something, and he just, like, beats it to death with a rock, and then skins it and eats it. And that's, like, the first, but he can't really eat anything, because he can't swallow, because he's got this gaping throat wound, so everything, like, comes out, and he has to, like, make a mash out of it and drink it with water, but he does find a way to, you know, to get and to start moving.
That's hardcore.
It's very hardcore. This whole thing is very hardcore.
Well, he leans against a log at one point that's covered in bugs, just so the flies can, like, go into his wounds and lay maggots so they can eat the gangrenous.
Well, and he cauterized it himself, right?
That was in the movie.
Yeah, that was. I'm pretty sure that didn't happen. I don't know. I don't know if that. I mean, I'm sure that physically can happen, but like putting gunpowder in your throat and lighting it up, I don't know how you know that wouldn't just blow up instead of just seal the wound.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Rambo 3. Come on.
Oh, sorry. History. Yeah.
Modern gunpowder is pretty explosive, but old black powder was just kind of a burn.
Okay. Still, not fun to watch.
No.
But even still, that is kind of what you're supposed to do if you're in that survival situation now, is you let the maggots eat the dead flesh, which, I mean, they like, even in hospitals, they have, like, clean maggots to eat the dead flesh away.
Do they hand clean the maggots?
Well, no, they're just bred that they're sterile maggots. I don't know what the fuck they do. Maggots gross me out anyway. But
I want to think it's some intern's job to scrub off the maggots.
With a little toothbrush. There you go, buddy.
Smaller maggots.
Yeah, let's not focus on the maggots for too much.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and as he was crawling, like, most of his wounds were healing because he could take care of them, except for the one on his back, which he couldn't get to, and he knew that was really the worst of them, aside from the one on his neck, I think.
You can see his fucking ribs, yes.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. Yeah, but, I mean, there's all these tales of what actually he did, and for all the, you know, we know that he survived, so he must have survived somehow, but he never, as far as we know, never sat down with anyone and, like, said, I did this and this and this. It's all based off of people who knew him afterwards and who talked to him and shared campfires with him, and that's how we kind of piece together, you know, what he did in the wild, because there was no one there with him when he was alone. But at one point, they're pretty sure he fought off a pack of wolves so he could get to a dead buffalo. You know, he found an abandoned village, and he killed a dog and ate it, and, you know, in the movie, I kind of didn't like the fact that, like, when he found the buffalo, like, the Indian was, like, he was there and, like, just gave him the food, but in real life, he apparently, like, you know, waved a firing brand at some wolves to scare them off, and literally that's how we got to the buffalo. The Indians helped him later on when he was, like, back on his feet, quote-unquote, when the Sioux actually took him in, like Matt was saying before, and, you know, fixed his back up and put on a poultice. It's a poultice, guys, by the way. I don't know why you spent 25 minutes discussing poultice on the last podcast. Sorry.
Boom!
Well, anyway. I mean, Amber thought, like, the...
Uh-oh.
The Indian was going to want a BJ or something from the from the meat.
He kept pointing to his mouth. I was like, oh, yeah, he wants it. He's like, I'll suck your dick, man.
Those fan fictions, though.
He survives, and he's surviving to survive, but also he wants to get back at the guys that took his rifle and left him for dead. And that's what we're meant to believe in this whole movie and in his life, is that's what's driving him, which... you know, it's
well,
a
in the
good
movie,
story.
It's his son,
right?
In real life, it's
which is
just
one of the oh, go ahead.
Rage and his rifle,
right? Which always, I mean, I was grumbling the entire. I was like, oh, the son wasn't there. Oh, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. Like, it just took. I mean, they had all these amazing. They were beautiful scenes of, you know, with the, when he catches up to the camp and he saves the girl from being raped and he kills the French traitors. And then there's this flight on horseback and he rides off a cliff into a tree. And then he, you know, lives in the belly of the horse for a night. But I felt like they didn't need to do that because his life was so amazing and his story was so unbelievable anyway. But, like, I just don't know why they sat around a table and, like, well, let's have him run off a cliff. Or that was, like, the studio saying, oh, you got to have a horse off a cliff.
So right. Was that in the book?
No, that wasn't in the book and it wasn't in real life as far as – no.
So I was thinking that, you know, it was in the book, so they were like,
In the book, like every day, I was just amazed, like how many you know shelters he built and how many like you know he made like when he was stuck in a snowstorm, he managed to make a you know an actual like shelter out of nothing. And they do show that in the movie where the Indian basically builds him a you know shelter.
As someone who hasn't, you know, I'd heard of him from the dollop, and the only reason they did the dollop was because they're like, oh yeah, and they're going to do a movie. So you know, as someone who knows nothing about it, I will say that even though all his adventures were amazing, I can kind of see that like. Okay, what's the heart of this? Because fighting and survival just for revenge is not nearly as emotionally affecting.
Which is kind of ironic because in the movie he ultimately doesn't get his revenge because he lets it go, you know, physically
right.
and metaphorically, and the Indians to do it. But and also we should mention the epigraph for the book, The Revenant, is the quote from Romans where it says, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. That's the theme of the book and the movie, and that's what most people ascribe to his tale, is the vengeance that he wanted on Bridger and Fitzgerald.
And he gets none of it. He just gets his rifle back. Yeah. Motherfucker.
Yeah, so he eventually, you know, finds his way back to his feet, crawls and then something like, I forget the exact miles that he ended up covering in his...
400.
Is it 400 miles? There you go. Yeah. Over the course of about 2 months, right?
Yep.
He eventually makes it back to the Sioux village, where he's kind of rescued at the... Oh, no, that's after the later attack. So he makes it back to, was it Fort Brazo, the trading post?
Fort Kiowa,
sorry. So many forts to keep track of in these stories.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'm looking at the map in the book. And his one thought, he's like, I need somebody to get me back west so I can catch up with Fitzgerald. And he joins up with another group of men heading north on the Missouri. And one day where I think it's pretty much accepted that he's on shore hunting, that the Arikara attack these guys, kill everybody except for him, and he survives again somehow.
He probably scared them off. He probably had a reputation by then.
Well, definitely among the you know the white men. I don't know how well the Indian. Well, no, they must have been spreading stories because the Sioux, you know, basically saved him and healed his back and everything.
Do we know how many there were in the attack party, or like how many they killed?
I believe were four or five in the boat. Right?
Yeah, him and some other guy lived.
Well, you know, something I hadn't thought of before was, you know, he gets his face, his back, everything gets mauled up, and it's not like they had plastic surgeons back then. He must have looked really terrifying for the rest of his life.
He probably had a very grisly look to him.
Get out, Greg.
All right, two can play that game. No, I forgot to mention, this is the group that had Toussaint Charbonneau was with him, right? Sacagawea's husband?
Charbonneau was Sacagawea's husband.
Right, he was with them in the second, because he was a known trader on the Missouri. This is all after Lewis and Clark, and Sacagawea had died like years ago, but he was at the fort, and he was part of the group that joined to go back, and I believe he was the only other guy that survived. Glass was on shore, but he somehow escaped the boat and like floated downriver.
I hadn't heard that, but that's really cool.
Yeah, that's in the book. It wasn't the movie at all, because they didn't touch on this at all, but no, he was definitely there. I'm pretty sure it was this attack. It might have been one of the other attacks, but it was here. So this is where Hugh was, you know, walking across in the forest again by himself, and these Arikaras start, you know, are on his trail. They're chasing after him, and then I believe it's a Mandan Indian, rescues him, like throws him on his horse, gets him to the village, and then they save him from the Arikara again. So that's how he's saved, literally, you know, by another Indian on horseback who gives him his horse and saves him.
Well, and the Mandan saved Lewis and Clark, too. They were always very friendly towards Westerners.
And they were kind of like the arch rivals of the Arikara, right? Them and the Sioux.
Right, I think so.
So yeah, so Hugh eventually, I mean, in the movie they kind of cover this in like very quickly, but this did take a couple months. I think he made it to the fort where everybody else was in December or January. And that's when he has his big meeting with Bridger, because Fitzgerald had already left by then. But he did have his great moment with Bridger, and basically he just forgives him. He's like, yeah, you're just a kid. It's not your fault. In the movie, was it Henry, like, punches him and arrests him? But I don't think that that probably didn't happen in real life.
Yeah.
Anything to say about the reunion with Bridger?
Bridger was probably a smooth talker or something, you know? Like we were saying earlier, 17 even now is like a full-grown dude, even though you're maybe a little immature. But I imagine he had to do some real explaining to Glass.
Well, and I think he did, and that's why Glass pardoned him. He's like, oh, you're stupid. Fitzgerald was the older guy. He talked you into it. Like, it's really his fault.
Yeah.
And Bridger, like we said earlier, like, goes on to be, like, you know, a renowned mountain man.
If not the most famous one.
Right. And in the biography, like, he quotes a couple different, you know, accounts of the actual meeting, because a lot of the people who were at the fort, you know, were told their stories or wrote their memoirs later on. And I don't believe this happened. I really, like, underline it. I was like, yeah, right. But at one point he says, go, my boy. I leave you to the punishment of your own conscience and your God. If they forgive you, then be happy. I have nothing to say to you. But don't forget hereafter that truth and fidelity are too valuable to be trifled with. I'm pretty sure it's more along the lines of, like, get out of here. That's probably what he said.
Yeah, like with two fingers over his, like, throat hole.
Yeah. Just growling at him the whole time. And that's, like, the abridged version of, like, this whole speech he gave, where he's like, young man, it is Glass that is before you, the same, not that content with leaving. Very Shakespearean. And he says, for your youth, I forgive you. Like, this is after a whole paragraph of very flowery language, so probably not.
Yeah, but he basically does the same thing to Fitzgerald later.
Well, Fitzgerald, he would have killed if he could, but he had joined the troops, and the commander was like, I can't let you kill my, I can't let you just kill a soldier, but here's your gun back.
Yeah. Right. But he's like, well, his conscience will eventually kill him, or, you know, will doom him to hell.
Right. Although, to be fair, in the book, like, that was one of the things that Punky, he knew that he had to have sort of a climax to the meeting with Fitzgerald, because he didn't have one with Bridger. And he has this whole scene where, like, they have this kind of mock trial, and they kind of acquit Fitzgerald, and then Hugh pulls out a pistol and shoots him in the shoulder. And it makes for fun reading, and then when you read in the back of the Revan and the historical note, he says...
That never happened.
There's no evidence of a formal proceeding such as I have portrayed. The character of Major Constable is wholly fictional, and the incident in which Glass shoots Fitzgerald in the shoulder is completely made up. So, at least he was honest about it.
Yeah, and Henry dies, like, 10 years later.
Oh, yeah, that was the whole thing in the movie where, like, he has this whole, like, villain in the snow, it pretends to be dead, and then Fitzgerald kills Henry, and then... It just was so over the top, but, like, that's where it was just so Hollywood for me, and I just, like, this is completely unnecessary, but it just really took me out of it.
It was also kind of predictable.
It was so predictable.
Yeah,
but why did he scalp him?
Because he's a bad guy.
But in the movie, like, was he trying to, like, play it off like the Indians killed him and not Fitzgerald, or...
I think he was already psycho at that point. Wasn't he just bitter because he'd been scalped and he was just going to scalp everybody?
I was so happy because at the point where, like, Glass gets back and he's like, where's Fitzgerald? And they, you know, Henry, like, throws the other guy. He's like, where'd he go? He goes, he said he was going to Texas to join up. I'm like, oh, they're going to actually have him join the army and it's going to be this whole... And then the next scene is, like, in the fucking mountains, like, traipsing and they're shooting at each other. I was like, give me a freaking break.
But that would have been 2 more hours. Of course,
I know that, but I was like, oh, they're doing something historically accurate. And then I was like, nope, they just said they might.
Well, and I thought the fight was ridiculous too. I mean, the whole movie is great in that it's brutal and everything is really realistic to say. And then you get to this fight and they're fighting for like 5 minutes, just stabbing and hacking at each other. They'd both be dead.
Yeah, somebody in the row behind me was like at the point where he stabs Hugh in the leg.
It was good.
He gets stabbed in
I
the leg.
Excited.
Yeah, somebody behind me goes, give me a break. So I know, like, that was the breaking point. Like, the whole thing was believable, except for the point where, like, he stabbed him in the leg, and he was like, give me a break.
Yeah, and doesn't at one point he chop off, like, Tom Hardy's hand?
He only got, like, the top of the fingers. He got, like, 3 fingers.
But he still keeps on, like, pointing a bloody stump into him. Like, it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And in real life, Hugh survives, lives another, you know, 10 years or so. But how the fuck is he going to make it back to the... Well, I guess, you know, he's Hugh Glass. He can do anything, but he's got a knife in the leg, can barely walk. But he's still, you know, got to get back to the village and to the fort.
Don't you doubt him.
I don't doubt Hugh. Hugh wouldn't doubt Hugh, I know.
So in the movie, like, Domhnall Gleeson was fantastic. And if you listen to the Nerdist podcast,
I'm so in love with him from listening to that.
Like the director was like, "Don't act so cold," and he's like, "It's fucking freezing. I can't act warm. This is how cold it actually is."
They filmed in Canada and Argentina.
Yeah, and they used only natural light, which is
really
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, so that's that was like one of the like things that made it like, you know, innovative
at.
Or whatever, but it's more like, oh, wow. Okay, so you totally fucked over your fucking crew.
Yeah, that must have been terrible. I mean, if you're shooting a scene at like sunrise and you mess it up, you'd be like, all right, wait till tomorrow.
Take five. I mean, 24.
Winter
take 24.
In Canada, it's going to last, you know,
yeah.
6 hours.
Yeah.
No, for all the nitpicking that we do with, you know, about the specifics, it was one of the most, you know, just beautiful movies that I've ever seen. You know, the scenes were breathtaking, especially they did the kind of weird, you know, where he was all looking up at the trees and that's how you knew time was passing. It was really beautifully done. I love that. It was just some of the history stuff that I had issues with.
Oh, yeah. And Greg, in the first scene, it was something about the wind. Like the wind will never stop, and that's why he kept on looking up at the trees and the wind and be like, okay, I'll never stop too.
Okay. All right. So I guess that makes a little more sense.
Something his wife said, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The scene that I had trouble with at the time was when he slept inside the horse.
Care to
but
explain?
I've learned since that he actually did get inside a horse. So.
Oh.
Christ.
Tom never pulled out the guts, did he?
Oh, no, he did. There was a whole scene of him just piling the guts and everything.
Han Solo?
Oh, Solo. Yeah. No, I thought you said Hugh. Sorry. No, Solo.
I know.
Han
Solo,
guts on 1977.
They look like white worms.
Yeah.
Maggots, right? Or pieces of rice.
Right. I'm
like, well, that's not so bad.
And you've managed to make it about Star Wars. Congratulations.
Yay.
We got there, guys. Yes. We got there.
So do you think you could fit in a horse body?
Now that I think about it, I think I could.
I know I couldn't, but
you'd really have to cut the rib cage in half, and because there's like the diaphragm, which separates all of the intestines and crap from the heart and the lungs and stuff, and the rib cage is over all of the heart and the lungs. So if you could cut through that, yeah, you might be able to. But he had like not like a bone saw.
Why don't you just pull out all the lungs and the hearts and just like use it as like a little heart shelter?
How many hearts, Matt? How many hearts does a horse have?
Well, it seems like the guts are getting
to
the warm part.
One, two.
I mean, you probably added it one.
Okay.
Pretty empty.
I mean, I actually don't know. I know a fucking cow has like four stomachs, so.
So it's a reasonable guess that maybe.
There might be a second heart there. I don't know.
Well, and when he's pulling out the guts, he does pull out two stomachs. That's something that I noticed.
And horses, does a horse have two stomachs too?
No.
Two
stomachs?
Maybe they could only get like certain, fake or real organs on set that day, and they had to go with two stomachs.
That's maybe one was like an inflated pancreas because it was running him too hard or something.
I'm gonna move us along. I'm gonna move.
Maybe
right
it was a mama,
this.
And that was like a fetus placenta.
Oh God!
Oh, maybe
we'll end at placenta.
Just to make it really nasty.
All right.
And then he had veal.
They say the younger it is, the fresher it is. Real tender.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. You okay there, Greg?
Oh, just waiting for you to be done.
I'm done.
All right.
So the liver.
Probably should have ate it, realistically speaking. I mean, he's out there starving and he just like throws all these guts out. You can eat like the heart and the liver and stuff.
The liver is huge with vitamins, so
yeah.
Wait, but according to another Dollop episode, if you
they're eating husky livers and their dick skin fell off.
Yeah, if you eat too much of a liver, they're like super high in vitamin C, which you'll overdose and like cause you to die.
No, vitamin A.
Vitamin A, yeah. I think were they polar bear livers? Is that what they were? It was when they were in Antarctica.
No, they're eating
right?
Husky livers because they're killing their dogs.
No, but I think the issue was that they were hunting polar bears, right? And it was they were eating the...
Well, the issue is that they were in Antarctica, and there are no polar bears there. So
okay, not Antarctica, the North Pole. Whatever. Wait a minute, which dollop are you thinking of? This is the one with the balloons, right?
Oh, I was talking about the one with their leg skin and dick skin fell off.
I think there's a couple
more. I don't remember that one.
No, it's where the balloon crashes. They were exploring the Arctic, and a balloon, it crashed, and they had to, like, survive, and they were shooting polar bears. I might be thinking of Damn Interesting. I get my history podcasts mixed up, but
yeah, I don't think I'm there on the dollop yet. But yeah, okay. I just listened to one with Shackleton's expedition to Antarctica, and the dude arrived after horrible. Like, he's a Hugh Glass of Australia.
Where, and that's saying something.
Yeah.
The bottom of his feet fell off, so he taped them on.
Oh.
His leg skin was falling off. His dick skin fell off.
Oh, my God.
And he got to the place where he's supposed to be.
Oh, and the ship had just left, right?
Yeah. And the ship left like 5 hours earlier.
Jesus.
But then they left him some food behind.
Well, they were eating husky livers, and apparently they're very high in vitamin A. And if you have too much of it, it can cause mental disorders, blindness, skin falling off.
Okay. I was thinking of, there's another podcast called Damn Interesting, which the Dollop actually had a little feud with for some episodes because they thought the Dollop was like stealing their topics and reading from their episodes. But they settled out of court. Everything's fine. But they did this episode about it's called Andre and the Aeronauts Voyage to the Top of the World. And it was where they were trying to get to the North Pole, and they're in a balloon, and of course it crashed and they were stuck and they had to like kill polar bears and that's how they survived. But they all went crazy and died because of the vitamin A overdose. Anyway.
Anywho.
Back to living.
Hugh Glass.
Yeah. So he gets his rifle back finally, and that's really the big thing, was that he got his he caught up to Fitzgerald, and the commander basically forces Fitzgerald to give him his gun back.
And also was like, no, we can't let a civilian just kill a soldier.
Yeah, bad precedent, he said.
Well, and he probably didn't even have the rifle at that point. It was probably in the arsenal, because back then soldiers weren't allowed to use their own weapons. That was a big deal.
He lost it gambling before he got there, probably.
Yeah.
Here's a rifle.
Yeah, that was a big deal back then. They had the scouts always had better guns than the actual regular soldiers, and the soldiers hated it
because they were allowed to use their own weapons.
Yeah, that was like in the wagon box fight over by Fort Phil Kearny in Wyoming. There were a whole bunch of regular soldiers, and they had single shot rifles, and the scouts had these Henry repeaters, which were new, and the soldiers weren't allowed to have them, and the soldiers hated it, and they ended up, a lot of them got killed because of it.
Yeah, interesting.
To quote here, just about the meeting between Glass and Fitzgerald, he says, "This meeting differed from the one with Bridger by its concluding by its concluding injunction, 'Give me my favorite rifle.'" And this is, the commanding officer ordered his rifle to be restored, and says, "So ended Hugh's quest in the service of love and hate, and the former proved stronger. But once he had his pet rifle in his hands again, he bore no one a grudge. Swearing Riley was a good fellow," that was the commander of the fort, "he shook his hand and strode contentedly forth." That's the end of that section.
Yeah, and that's after, like, would we just say that, like, only him survived an Indian attack, and then he went another 200 miles to this fort?
Yeah.
I mean, that's fucking bananas.
The whole thing is, it's almost too much to believe. It's like, okay, I can believe any one of these things, or two of these things, but this is only, you know, there's still a whole, he's got 10 years to live, and in his later years, some other crazy shit happens too, which we can, you know, go over really quick, but there's a reason that this was, you know, and this is when his legend starts to spread, and he sort of becomes like the, even among the mountain men and all these trappers, he becomes like their, you know, he becomes their representative when they have this feud with the fur company. Like, he's actually sent to like break up a monopoly of among the trappers, the companies, and he's one of the most, probably the most respected you know, trapper out there.
Well, yeah, him, Jebediah Smith, but yeah,
he's definitely in the top few, but
a top few?
The top few.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel good about that one.
Who hasn't made a pun yet? Amber, you have to make a pun.
Amber.
Me.
Yeah,
something about beavers.
We'll get there.
It's all about beavers.
I mean, the other kind of theme of this, I guess they did touch it in the movie, was that Glass always wanted his solitude and was always kind of a little bit of an outsider. And I know, Jack, you had kind of said, like, you were questioning if he really was so much of an outsider. Did you want to talk about that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I have no evidence to say he wasn't, other than a guy, John S. Gardiner, got killed in one of his earlier expeditions, and Glass was the guy to write back to his family. So maybe he was just the only literate guy there, or maybe he was friends with Gardner. At least that's what I thought when I read it.
Right. And if correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the only actual document we have that's written in Glass's hand. You know, that's where we actually hear his words was the letter, because the guy's father kept it and it was found, you know, years later among his belongings, I think.
Right.
Yeah, and I think he signed it like "Your beloved servant, Hugh Glass."
Yeah.
Well, and at some point I wanted to talk about questioning the truth of the entire story of him living, because
you don't think it happened?
Well, I think a lot of it might have been exaggerated. Obviously, he did get mauled and he did get back to the fort, but all the stuff about the rattlesnake and the dog and the wolves and everything might have been entirely made up, because the first written account of it we have is from a lawyer in Philadelphia in 1824, which is just the next year. And I don't know how a lawyer in Pennsylvania heard about Glass's exploits in the Dakotas within a year.
Well, what did he actually, was it a full account? Because as far as the biographies that I read, they talked about that there really wasn't a full account until this German prince came over, and he was Prince Maximilian of Weld, I believe his name was, and he paid all these people to get the story, and he was one of the first guys that wrote everything down by taking everyone's accounts, and his account does differ a lot from what, you know, the quote-unquote legend actually, you know, in the specifics, what it says.
He's the guy in the movie Maverick. Because they just were romanced by this lifestyle of, you know.
That guy was Russian, and he wanted to kill an Indian, if I recall.
No, but I mean, there were those people that were just
interested. Was because there was nowhere in Europe that was considered, you know, untouched yet, and the American West was, and all these, you know, Russian and European and German princes and counts would come over and have these. They thought they were having the true American rustic adventure, but everything was, you know, planned for them and, you know, stuff like that.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I mean, that's why it's all written down. And then what was it? The guy in the poet in 1920s, mm-hmm.
Are we already John Neihardt,
the Aryan race guy. Yeah, yeah, it's just a weird obsession with that part of history.
Well, he talked in, you know, about how when he was a boy, the first time he saw the raging Missouri, this thing of wonder filled through him, and he wanted to make sure that these people lived on in American memory for all the good Aryans out there.
Yeah, and at the time, you know, the Europeans, I think the Europeans are still very enamored with the Old West. But even the people on the coast were enamored with this stuff. There were all sorts of tabloid, almost comic books that were made about these people while they were alive.
Yeah.
And they were grossly exaggerated a lot of the time.
Right, in Unforgiven, The Duck of Death.
Yeah, The Duck of Death, yeah.
The Duck of Death.
Love that movie.
Didn't we talk at one point of doing a VOC on Unforgiven?
Yes. It was probably while I was watching it. I was like, I love this fucking movie. Let's talk about it.
William Money. This is just a quote I found about Glass's solitude. And I don't think he was didn't like people or talk to people, but I think he appreciated his solitude. And I kind of respect that, where it says, he astonished even a crew of ferociously independent scatterlings by his scorn of group cooperation. He had enlarged his autonomy by sleeping of nights by his separate campfire. The others often didn't know where he was located, as Clark was furthermore told, but Hugh always knew where the others were and answered any shout of alarm by swiftly rallying. So he was always part of the group, but he was probably towards the outside.
Well, the mountain men are famous for just being social outcasts anyways. It's not like you're...
Thought you were going to say they're just famous for being social.
It's not like they... it's not like a banker would just get up and walk out into the mountains. These were guys that really didn't like society that much, and that's why they did this stuff.
Well, I feel like Into the Wild, they talk about a bunch of people just getting lost because they just didn't care for society. And the guy McClandis, whatever,
McCandless.
Yeah, was the same way. He's just like, I want to do this, fuck this. And a lot of people, well, I mean, obviously back then it was different, but a lot of people in today times, it's more like there's no rite of passage to become a man anymore,
right?
And they see going on some stupid expedition, you know, or living, tramping around is the way to become a man and or find yourself.
Well, I can definitely commiserate with a lot of that stuff. You know, the reason why I became a fish and wildlife management guy out here in Montana is because, You know, I really, truly like being alone in the wilderness. And you know, if I could get some land to build a cabin on or something out here, I would absolutely live out on my own. I don't know if I would do it for, you know, years at a time. But a couple months up by yourself is very relaxing when you're surrounded by nature.
And then I don't like it. I don't like it when Sam gets in my toes. And heaven forbid there be bugs.
Yeah, ugh, bugs.
Yeah, mosquitoes are the worst.
Yeah, so we'd probably just talk about what actually happened to Hugh after, you know, in real life. He did join up again. He actually was one of the first people that, I guess the term is blazed. He blazed the Santa Fe Trail and was one of the first trappers to head, you know, to the southwest and make it there. But he ended up coming back to, you know, the northwest and the Missouri. And he eventually, at one point, he was on another expedition, and they, where is it here? This is, I call this the third attack.
Oh, where he thinks he's speaking with Pawnee, and...
Yeah, well, they were in a boat, and they had killed a, they had, like, extra meat. They were like, oh, let's give our extra food to this, these Indians. So they like, hailed this Indian, but, like, they don't know, they think she might have been deaf, or she didn't see them until they were right on top of her, and she, like, screamed and raised the village. And, yeah, it turns out they were Rickarees again. And Hugh, literally, one guy was, like, shot and he was dying. And Hugh made it back to the boat and they were going to get away. But the guy, like, yelled out, I want to die with my rifle loaded. So Hugh got out of the boat, went back to the guy, loaded his rifle, and then ran back to the boat. And that's when he got shot with an arrow.
20 minutes later.
Yeah. So he says it took 2 or 3 arrows from the savage that had wounded Glass in the back. And Dubreuil was the guy he left behind. Just as Dubreuil was raising his rifle to fire, an arrow passed through his throat, and he fell dead at the same moment with the Indian.
Oh, I was just going to say, didn't he get one of those arrows in the spine?
The guy died. That was Hugh. Dubreuil took the guy who died. He's the guy who got shot in the throat. And then it says Hugh Carey was shot in the back. Hugh carried the arrowhead. He carried it in his spine, riding 700 miles over unburied country. Because they couldn't take the arrow out, because it was literally lodged in his spine. And they ended up having some barber take it out in, like, a trading post. But nobody really knows who it was, and there's no actual record of... But it says, because of the shadowy figure's nerve and skill, Glass not only survived, but was restored to campaign vigor. So that was the last attack by the Indians, as far as I know, until he's actually killed by them later on.
So, I mean, it really sounds like... Jack, you would, like, have a more will to live out in the wilderness, where I would just, like, be like...
Take me now.
Fuck this. This is the worst.
No, I understand that. Like, I have great... I used to go camping as a kid, but it was always... I always was so happy just to get back, even to the tent, or just to get back home. Like, I'm not pampered by any means, but I just don't... That's not my thing, but I definitely understand and respect people who have, that's your connection to, call it whatever you will, higher power or just nature in general.
Maybe he didn't have nerve endings. Like, maybe he just didn't realize how badly he was injured. He just was like, fuck it, let's go. It's a little blood.
Yeah.
Just maybe a little arrow got torn up by that bear.
Yeah.
Also, to be fair, after the bear attack, any other pain is probably nothing compared to what he went through. It's just like, I've seen worse.
Been there, done that.
Explain.
No, he would just be like, been there, done that.
Oh. I thought you were speaking of personal experience.
Okay. I mean, let's hear about this beaver too, again. But nothing that holds a candle to that.
So just to cover pretty much the end of Glass's life, what happened, this is 1833, which is basically 10 years after the bear attack. He was out hunting in what he thought was friendly territory. They thought that, you know, they were, I believe it was near the Sioux, but him and two other trappers were crossing a river, and that's when they were ambushed by this roving band of Arikara. We don't know if it's the same band, but it was they were passing through this land that they thought was safe. And they basically ambushed them, killed them all on this frozen river, scalped them, took their stuff. And we don't have an actual account of his death, but they know because later on, when those Indians were killed, they had his belongings with him and they had his rifle. And a guy actually, like this other guy named Gardner, I don't think he's any relation to the guy he wrote the letter to, but he was the guy that kind of like took it on himself to avenge Hugh Glass. And he, you know, hunted the Indians down, killed them. And one of those scalps he actually presented to Prince Maximilian, the guy who wrote the account. And... He said Maximilian was always proud of the scalp, but no one ever told him that the gift of human hair was that it had been wrenched loose while its owner was still alive.
Oh,
that guy, Johnson Gardner is who the town that's the entrance to Yellowstone is named after. That town is called Gardner after him.
Oh,
really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's that big stone gate that you always see in like Yogi Bear, but you also see.
I've taken my picture by that.
Yeah, that's in Gardner, Montana.
So one thing I had a big issue with was they started off in South Dakota, but then they went to Yellowstone, and then he crawled back. Like, are these mileage correct? I mean, that is a ton of fucking...
When did he go to Yellowstone?
Wasn't it the Southwest?
He caught up with the fort that he caught up with them on was on the Yellowstone River. Was that Fort Union, I believe?
Oh, maybe I'm confusing that because they keep, especially in the movie, they keep on like saying that they're in Yellowstone.
They're referring to the river, I believe.
Yeah, and it probably wouldn't even be called that back then because the park hadn't been discovered yet, or maybe it had.
Or founded.
It
wouldn't be founded until.
Teddy Roosevelt,
yeah.
Which is
no, the park was there. No, they were like there was these ancient park rangers were been guarding Yellowstone for many many years. And can we come in? No.
Just sit down at the picnic table. What the fuck?
Yeah, the
guy.
One of the guys.
Hey Hugh.
From Lewis and Clark's expedition
Was that a Yogi Bear Hugh Glass matchup?
Yep, I think so.
Hugh. Jesus. Yeah, I'm looking at the map, and actually back then it was called the Yellowstone. Like it was two words. It was the Yellowstone River, and that's over time has been shortened to Yellowstone.
It probably had been found at that point. Then it was a guy from Lewis and Clark's expedition that found Yellowstone. He's the one who came back and told everyone about it, and they thought he was nuts.
Right, because there's a literal Yellowstone.
Yeah, because of the sulfur springs there.
Can I just say that that's my favorite place?
It's pretty nice.
Never been.
I've been three times.
It's like an hour from where I live.
I really loved Estes Park in Colorado when I went there. That's the most nature I've experienced, I think. Except for that time we almost drowned in a river. That was in New Hampshire.
Yeah, do tell about how these
oh, it was all my dad's fault. He just misjudged like when the sun was going to go down. He's like, oh, we got all day. We were just going for a day hike. And it was like, my mom's like, it's like 5 o'clock and the sun's going down. He's like, no, we're near the car. It's fine. But we were like 6 miles off of where we thought we were.
Oh,
and we realized we had to cross this river to get back to like the actual park because we were just walking in the woods. And we were like, well, we'll throw a line across and then we'll go across. And we had two dogs with us. And there were these like other people camping on the other side that actually came into the river and like made a human chain and pulled us over.
Aww.
But it was terrifying, but quite exhilarating. My brother, little brother, loved it. I peed my pants in the river, and my mom was like, "This is it. We're getting a divorce. This is your throw. This is the last time you've done this to us." And everything was fine after that, but it was terrifying for us city folk.
You. Yeah. How old are you?
I was 13 or 14.
That's pretty hardcore.
That's why I didn't want to cross that damn channel at the beach today, Matt.
You needed a human chain.
Yeah. So that's the story of Hugh Glass. Biggest badass in American history. He's up there.
I would say he's top five.
Do we think... I kind of feel like... I mean, everything in his life is so epic. It almost seems anticlimactic that it's just like, oh, yeah, Indians eventually got him. You know, they tried enough.
Oh, absolutely. That was when I got this biography. And even in the Revenant, the book, like, it's literally, oh, they were crossing a river. And it literally says right here, Old Glass with two companions had gone from Fort Cass to hunt beavers on the Yellowstone. And as they were crossing the river on the ice farther down, they were all three shot, scalped, and plundered by a war party of 30 Arikaras. That's it. Like, it's a very ignominious end, but it does go on to say, like, he literally died, you know, not to be uncouth, but, like, at the perfect time, because the next year was when the bottom fell out of the trap of the beaver, the pelt industry, because, you know, cloth hats were now all the rage, and no one wanted beaver hats anymore. And
call it the beaver industry.
I almost did, and I stopped, but I should have.
The oldest profession.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
So maybe not feathered hats, but beaver hats?
Sure, why not?
Anyone? Get it?
Oh,
no, we got it.
Oh, okay. I just got it.
It just wasn't that good? Sorry, I was
just
looking at
that. You're in the pun club, no worry.
Yeah, our puns have not been good
this
evening.
It's a reference. It's a cult reference.
That reference was unbearable.
God damn it.
Nope.
So we highly recommend the dollop. We only really did this so we could just spread the word of the dollop, even though we do that on pretty much every episode. But check out the dollop. It's a great podcast.
Pretty fantastic. So
Matt, did you start at the beginning?
I did. And I'm at like episode like 105 now.
Oh, Jesus.
I started months ago, like maybe a year ago, and I'm on 70.
No, there's a huge queue of Nerdist. There's even a queue of VOKs that I haven't listened to. What's that?
Nerdist has gone to once a week now, so that makes it a little easier instead of three times a week.
Right. So there's that. Couple other podcasts that only go once a week. But yeah, no, I've just been devouring dollops.
I guess.
Yum, 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 yum. Dollop.
Just a dollop.
Yeah, I just had a couple other, like, you know, discussion points. Major Henry just seemed to have the worst luck out of anybody because, like, every single one of his expeditions just ended in failure or you know, bankruptcy. And, you know, the original attack by the Rees, like, they were literally shot at with the guns that he had given them when they traded with them, like, the year before. And that must have burned with him a little bit. But he did end up retiring and, you know, living out his life. He did not get murdered by Fitzgerald.
No, he lived like 10 years longer.
That's a long life.
It is for them.
For the frontier.
And I just figured we'd end it with this quote. This was another one from the biography where he talks about Glass and he says, "He had what might be called four incarnations, the pre-Western existence, of which he never spoke beyond saying that he had been a mariner. On the doorstep of middle age..."
Pirates.
Pirates.
"On the doorstep of middle age, he had been pared away from all the associations he owned as a decent seafaring man and had wallowed in slime beneath a skull and crossbones. Escaped from corruption, he had been dragged back to the Neolithic era by the wolf Pawnees. Now he had climbed halfway back to the centuries, roving with the other homeless white hunters. There was once a civilized modern man who was thrust as far back in dawn living conditions as Pithecanthropus, and there left desperately crippled. The tale of what he did thereafter is splintered by differing reportings, and it must be pieced together with the aid of side remarks sifted from documents dealing with other matters. Yet the principal events can be clearly followed. However fragmentary its form, the narrative is a great one. It is likewise, according to the verdict returned with this appraisal, a thoroughly true one." That's all Hugh's story.
He went into the hippocampus? That's a part of the brain.
That's the memory part of the brain.
Yeah.
No, it's like an early, like Homo erectus. It's like an early,
Yeah.
What? It's one of the, it's...
Guys, Greg said erectus.
Children, you're all children.
Either.
First time I read that, I thought it was that little dinosaur from Jurassic Park that ate the guy, but that's like the campy something.
The big fat guy?
No, the bad guy.
Newman?
Like, no!
Yeah, Newman!
That was the Dilophosaurus. I know the Dilophosaurus. In the Lost World, the little ones that kill the guy who's like stabbing him with the, the taser. The campies. Whatever they're called.
The little tiny raptor things.
Yeah.
They're like Dilophosauruses or something.
Dilophosaurus is the one with the and the neck thingy, and he spits the venom. That guy.
That's this guy knows.
Oh, so no. Those are the dinosaurs that actually kill Hammond in the actual book.
Oh yeah, in the book, that's the little ones. Not the Dilophosaurus. Yeah. Oh yeah, Hammond's
the little
dead
chicken ones with the poisonous bites.
Right, but
aren't
not
they
in
all
the
chicken
movie
ones?
Well, if you believe that.
Allegedly.
Yeah, the ones that Jesus made.
Yeah.
Well, there is that. Is it Jack Horner?
Jesus made dinosaurs?
Duh. He rode dinosaurs.
Oh.
He made them so that he could ride them.
Who just posted that?
Is that Amber's pun? You're just...
Yeah. Google pun.
I'll try not to make you puma your pants. I guess we've been in the after show for quite some time, but let's at least record an exit to the episode so I can copy and paste that. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on our discussion of The Revenant and Hugh Glass.
Hugh Glass. It's like Hugh Jazz. No?
With an L in it?
Jesus, trying to keep it classy.
More like glassy.
You picked the wrong group of
folks. Oh, fuck this.
Only you and no one else can keep me crawling back. You know I can't help myself, and now I'm crawling back.
All right, now we're in the after show.
Bye, thanks.
Bye-bye.
There,
bye.
Bye, thanks. You can record a proper after show intro later.
I think I will.
Well, 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 welcome to the after show, folks.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that was aggressive.
Yeah. That's the morning zoo version of VOK. Caller number 9.
Yep.
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 So my mountain man drink of choice, again, is bourbon.
So you're a mountain man every day?
Yeah, but it's March, so there's no beard. Only rock the beard from September to March.
Oh, you've got rules.
Oh, yeah. There's beard season. I have
a beard.
What's that?
Are you old enough to grow one, though?
Old enough to grow a beard? I'm a naturally hairy Irishman.
It's a lot of information right there.
We usually don't mention our level of body hair until the second or third podcast, but that's great.
Or to a guy's night out.
Yeah. And there's so many of those.
Yep.
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 All right. I guess we're good to go.
Okay. Hold on. Let me just switch screens here, y'all. All right.
Here's the notes again in case anybody does not have them. I don't see anybody in the doc, so get in that doc, V.
I am working on it.
I know everything. Why do I need a doc?
I know.
You can see who's looking at it?
You can just see how many people are in it. You know, with the... That's what all those animals discussions are about in the after shows on every single podcast. What animal are you? Who are you? Am I the wet manatee?
I've never seen that.
Excuse me? You're the wet manatee?
There's no animals right now.
Better not be a fucking narwhal.
No. It's hunting season on narwhals.
So where do the animals show up? I forgot about this. I'd heard this before, and I have no idea.
On mine, it's in the top right corner. It just shows who's in the dock.
What animal am I?
I don't see any animals there now.
I'm in the dock.
I don't believe you.
I'm looking at the dock.
I am now.
Did I lie to you, Greg?
No. I don't know. That's weird.
Maybe I should be the beaver for this episode.
Well, clearly I should be the beaver for this episode.
Let's just have the beaver discussion right now. Let's get all the giggles, everything out of our system. There we go. Someone's a beaver. No fucking way. You're an anonymous beaver. How could you plan that?
What?
There's an anonymous beaver in the dock.
Where are you seeing these animals?
It's in the top. It says, like, comments and share. There's, like, a picture of a pink. I almost said a picture of a pink beaver. But there's a picture of a pink beaver.
I only see the little edit pencil.
Yeah, so do I. Oh,
whoever is at the top beaver. Left corner of the dock is an anonymous beaver. Whoever's cursed.
That's me.
You're an anonymous beaver, then. Yep. And now you're gone. Now you're Jack.
Yeah,
oh, you signed in.
Yep.
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 Today we'll be recovering the movie, the film. Oh, wow, I can't talk.
We're recovering?
Hello, everyone. Okay. Welcome to Vassal. Everyone, shut up. Hello, everyone.
Beavers.
Welcome. All right, Matt. We're going to get to the beavers.
Yep.
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 Apparently is a bragger the rest of his life. What the fuck was that?
What was that?
Was that Chihuahua?
It's Chihuahua, Matt. It's Chihuahua.
Who let the dogs out?
Oh, don't. Yep.
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 Oh, this one's... You all right? Sorry. The chinchilla, he dreams sometimes and he has these nightmares and he makes these weird noises. It freaks the crap out of me.
Oh, Davos.
He's all right. He's all right. He's all right, Dave. It's all right. Anyway, sorry.